Welcome to Green Beard Podcast. This is Mike Sack.
Honey.
Austin.
Charlie. Austin. You guys have already forgotten your special name.
Oh, it's not forgotten. I'm Step Up Transformer.
I'm Impudence, Honey.
Yeah, no, Smooth Power over here. Just was testing everyone. Anyway, on this week's episode, or just this episode, we have a very, very special beer that we're going to be debuting again. It's a combination of my home state, maple, you could guess it, it's from Vermont. It's a maple bacon IPA. Yeah, we're going there. And it's going to be tasty, that's for sure. A lot better than the salty clamaganza. So Charlie, beyond our maple bacon beer or beer stack or however we want to call this, what else are we drinking?
Well, so the beer behind, and we talked about this at lunch, as somebody said, we've blown right past the comfort zone of any beer purists already, but we're continuing that trend in our search for the New England version of the Bo Rita, which is really a mid-Atlantic creation, the Natty Bo with the Old Bay on the rim. Yep. We've had what I think we would generally call a failed attempt to find the New England version, which was a Narragansett with a clam base.
I think it was the right two beer and I guess flavors. They just don't go well together.
It was
brilliant conceptually and weak execution.
Exactly.
We're
nothing if not, what would you call it, stubborn or perseverant. And we decided there has to be a New England version of the Bo Rita. So today we debut, as you said, Mike, the maple bacon. And in a further step beyond the purest comfort zone, we're pouring a craft beer here with this one. This is the Vermont IPA from Long Trail, which is an excellent beer in its own right. If you look at like a New England IPA, the version from Long Trail is really good. So we've got a Long Trail New England IPA with the maple bacon rim. Still looking for names for this one. We're taking suggestions.
Wow.
And... I suppose anything with maple and bacon is going to be good, but here we go.
Yeah.
You should see these cups, listeners. If this were a video series, you'd be truly horrified.
Wow.
Wow. That is good.
Anything with
bacon on the laptop.
No, anything with maple and bacon.
Mm-hmm. We're good.
Yeah, I got some bacon bits. We should say, well, we got a back up here and talk about how we made our bacon bits in the office microwave.
Yeah,
ladies and gentlemen, Turns out that you can crisp up bacon perfectly fine in a high power microwave.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone in the office will know that you're up to
the neighboring
bacon.
The neighboring offices were none too pleased, but that's actually really good.
Yeah, it's really good.
It actually really works.
We need a name.
So I think one of the mistakes, you don't want bacon bits, probably bacon strips. Because it's real, you're sort of just like, it's tough.
What would you do with the strip, though?
It sort of has a sort of backwash element to it.
But you're getting the cloudy IPA, the hops. There's a little salt from the bacon, which is not unpleasant at all. It's actually quite tasty.
Nice.
And the little hint of maple just complements the hoppiness.
Yeah.
And we had the salt in the clamaganset. But we've just replaced the fishiness that accompanied that salt with sugary sweets.
Really sure. Good call.
Yeah.
And Charlie, where'd come up with the name for this?
I was thinking along the lines of a diner breakfast. So I was thinking this is the beer stack.
The beer stack. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like stacking flavors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Doesn't have the same ring as Clamaganset. We're going to work on the name, but I think we may have found our New England version.
Honest to God, it works.
Answer to the Clamaganset, to the Bo Rita.
Just have napkins and wet wipes. Wet wipes ready. It is, maple syrup is makes a mess, but it's good.
Yeah, really like it. So there you have it. We'll get back to the ratings at the end. Or do you want to rate it now, Ani?
Go for it.
I rated the Clamagansett a 3, which I think may have been overly enthusiastic.
No.
I would rate this north of... I would rate this a 7. I give this a 7. Meaning I would do this again.
You'd actually do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I would certainly do it again. We got to work on the delivery method of how to actually put it on the rim, because it sort of it floats down the cup and onto the plate. Either way.
This goes to what you had said earlier. Sorry to cut you off, but you mentioned about how you want to keep this in the fridge.
Yes.
Kind of freeze the maple and bacon blend.
That would have worked well.
Another, we could make a maple toffee. And then have a rope of it underneath. Look, these glasses have a little lip. They have like a little, a thin rope of maple toffee.
I think we're on to something. I think just slightly stickier or
maple
frozen.
Maple butter, you know?
Yeah.
Maple butter.
Yeah, maple butter.
Would hold the bacon bits.
Yeah, a lot better.
All right.
Okay.
We're going to keep iterating.
It's an 8. For okay. Eight. Yeah.
An 8? It's the first time Mike has ever rated something higher than me.
It's actually the best beverage he's had in the entire history of the podcast. No, it can't be that. 5.5.
5.5. 5.5 meaning better than your average beverage choice.
Yeah, if we say that 5 is average, then this for sure.
I agree. All right, so the actual beer for today's beer tasting on Green Beers is the Conehead IPA from Zero Gravity in Burlington, Vermont.
Yes.
We are... featuring Mike's home state, Vermont, today in our beers.
Tell us about Burlington, Mike. Is it nice? I hear it's nice.
It is nice. So these guys, Zero Gravity, they brew on Pine Street.
Fitting.
Pine Street was about, I'd say, less than a mile. I poured a full cup.
There you go. We have two. We have two tall boys. We are at work, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, we are still at work.
It's got me talking about Pine Street. A lot of good memories. My high school was about a half mile from there, and I worked at an oven factory in the summers about a half mile from there as well. There's a wonderful deli called the Pine Street Deli. We used to get Rubens there all the time. Great place, great place. But about the brewery, they weren't around when I was there.
They're relatively new.
Yeah,
they started at American Flatbread. They started as a brew pub at American Flatbread, which is a great pizza place. Well, there's a few of them in Vermont. I don't know where the original one was. But now they have their own tap room. What do we think?
It is resiny and piney. I don't know what kind of hops. Do we know what kind of hops they have in here? Right. Fittingly, right, if Conehead alludes obviously to a hop cone, but to a pine cone in a way, it really has a bit of tree sap character in a good way.
Yeah.
But less citrusy to me and more resiny.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So what do you think, Mike?
It's smooth.
Austin?
Definitely smooth, but if you're expecting that citrus explosion that's really common in a lot of IPAs, then that's not what this is.
Then what is it?
It is, I will say, it's only 5.7
doesn't taste
ABV,
very alcoholic,
which is nice for an IPA.
It does not taste very alcoholic.
Yeah.
No. And Mike, could you talk about their sustainability index?
Yeah.
Mike or Charlie?
I will, yes. Sustainability wise, oh, by the way, it's Citra hops.
Okay.
You're right. It doesn't have that sort of citrusy.
Yeah.
Citra is somewhere between the West Coast piney hops and the.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It is very good, very smooth, not too bitter, and low alcohol. So it's very tasty. They did not have any. Clear sustainability program at Zero Gravity. It turns out, in fact, as we've discussed in earlier podcasts, that water use is the big issue for breweries. And in the spring of 2018, and in summer of 2018, about a year ago, there were a series of water pollution events in Lake Champlain that were attributed in part to the spike in craft breweries and the amount of water that those craft breweries were using. So Zero Gravity and the other medium-sized breweries in Burlington are now working with the city. They've installed
meters to evaluate their water quality before it goes to the city's water treatment facility. The beer waste complicates the ability of the water treatment facility to fully manage it. So a number of breweries are managing their water on site. I don't know if Zero Gravity wasn't one of them, but they were certainly cooperating with the city to address this. So sustainability is almost built in to the game plan if you're going to run a successful brewery in a state like Vermont.
Yeah, interestingly, the issue was excess sugars, right, and then, of course, phosphates from cleaning. And phosphates are always a problem, so non-phosphate cleaners are good for
right.
domestic use. But, of course, if you're cleaning a brewery, imagine the quantity of cleaner you need to clean out the mash tun.
Right.
So, and then sugar plus phosphate overwhelms the system. So, and instead, I think it was Magic Hat, at least, was mentioned in an article we read that had installed a digester on site
yes.
to take care of that sugary water, which that effluent, they said, could be up to 2% sugar, which is way higher percent of sugar, of course, than regular brown water from a home. And so that's the issue.
Yep, and Magic Hat, which is a brewery in South Burlington, Vermont, which is a separate water treatment program facility, water treatment plant for that community.
Yeah.
As you say, Magic Hat installed their own digester, which is what, as we talked about a couple weeks ago, Treehouse has done.
Yep.
So they're managing all of their own waste and from that creating heat and power for their facility.
Yeah, yep. And Magic Hat did that 10, 12 years ago. Now, that was back in 2007 that they installed that digester. So it's certainly an issue for all small breweries going forward is how do they control that? And a digester is a way of doing that. It's also a way of creating energy and whether that's creating power on site and having a distributed generation that's fueled by the gas you're creating or, selling that gas as RNG. There's a couple of great ways to really be full circle here and contribute to the circle economy.
Yep, and it's amazing. I don't think it would ever have occurred to me, and we're in the business, that the growth of craft breweries in a city like Burlington would have a measurable effect on that city's water quality. But of course, it makes sense once you hear about it that it does. And what's great is these businesses tend to be really community oriented, and apparently they've all willingly and happily rallied to the cause to figure out a better way to manage their water. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think Vermont is probably a leader just because it's Vermont, and they typically swing extremely hard towards the environmental issues.
Yeah,
but
I've heard of a leftist senator from Vermont.
Yeah, you might have heard of him. He's
Massachusetts as well.
Anybody up here in the Northeast is pretty much swinging that way. But I think going forward, looking at commercial uses of, being responsible. It's not just about, all right, they want to sell a product to a consumer. They want to be a part of the circular economy.
Yeah.
It's about how do they work inside of these regulations. And, this is a great way of that, how they're doing it. So.
Well, and it's interesting, one of the breweries in Burlington was saying that to comply with the city's new wastewater management rules, specific to breweries, it's going to cost them $100,000 a year. First thing that came to my mind is there was clearly an upfront capital cost for Magic Hat in installing that digester, but not only would they not have the $100,000, they're probably saving a ton on energy. So perfect fit for our model. You do have to make the upfront investment in the digester, but I'm betting the long-term business decision to install a digester is better than the $100,000 a year in compliance costs to the city.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So
sustainability is good business.
Absolutely.
That's our motto. So what do we think of the beer, rating-wise? Mm. Austin?
I like it, but I enjoy the Treehouse Hazy New England IPA a little more, I think. I'll give her a six. But it's not my number one favorite.
Okay. Wow. That's a pretty big jump,
Jump. What do you mean?
From the maple beer.
5.5.
Which again, 5.5.
Yeah.
Just slightly more enjoyable than that monstrosity we put together earlier.
All right. Fair enough. I would say for me, this is, an 8.2.
Lordy.
It's pretty good.
Lordy, you guys don't give yourselves much room up on the top end. What happens when you taste a beer that changes your life?
Charlie?
We're dealing intensive points at that point. So I like this. I don't like it as much as the Mystic or the Treehouse, obviously, which is my number one beer. I would give this a mid-sevens. I think it's a very good IPA, particularly because it's low ABV and it is smooth. But I also like the hazy, juicier IPAs. But nonetheless, it's a good one with a little bit of a citrus. Yeah, but this is good. This is good. I would definitely recommend it.
Okay. All right, well, that's this week's beer review. On to energy efficiency and renewables will be our next topic. All right, welcome back to Green Beers. On this week's episode, we're going to talk about energy efficiency versus, you know, on-site power, or, you know, really why energy efficiency is considered, you know, not as sexy as solar, right? You know, you never see anybody having a ribbon cutting for LED lighting projects, right? The governor doesn't show up for that one. But they certainly will for solar, which at the end of the day is not as good of an investment as, you know, I love solar. I was in solar development for a long time. And unfortunately, it's very much backed by heavy incentives from the government to make it work. And so I just want to talk about really why energy efficiency, why we do what we do, which for a lighting project, it's not uncommon to see a one-year payback.
Right.
Right.
Well, it's interesting because we live this all the time. We will get into a conversation with a customer about our efficiency project, and almost always we get the request to throw some solar in because, as you say, it's just sexier. They know the panels on the roof will generate conversation. They can talk about it in a way that makes people feel really good. And efficiency just doesn't, you know. And I'm not sure we're ever going to be able to solve that, but we should maybe explore that too. How do we make efficiency sexy?
But you can't see it.
Yeah.
It's part of it, right? You can see wind turbines and you can see solar. And you can see if you're in, you can see a coal plant that is no longer there. It used to be there, but it's easy to go unnoticed. But there's a reason that it's referred to as the first fuel, right? I think the great Amory Levins of Rocky Mountain Institute, sort of the father of energy efficiency, called it, and it's written many articles to this effect on why it needs to be the first fuel. And you can think of it that way, right? That reducing your energy consumption by 20% is akin to acquiring an energy resource. You say discovering more oil or gas back in the day when we thought that was good, or snapping your fingers and making the sun shine 20% more often. So recall, of course, that in a place like New England, as fun as solar is, it's cloudy here a lot. This is not a great place for solar, in fact. Saudi Arabia, thumbs up. Tibet, thumbs up. Parts of Mexico, awesome. Northeast, good. Not as good as efficiency, because efficiency always works. You don't depend on the sun shining or the wind blowing. And for renewable generation, you do. So start with efficiency.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, as you pointed out, Austin, the tension between renewables and efficiency is not just the sort of perception of its attractiveness to a customer for from a marketing perspective, but there's real fundamental gaps in the ability of renewables to deliver what customers are looking for. Now, we're all for renewables here at Renew. We don't get any of us wrong, nothing against renewables, but there are challenges with investing in it, and there are certainly challenges in moving to it as the only answer for meeting carbon goals. And what's interesting is that we've been having conversations with regional environmental groups about this issue. As we've talked in earlier podcasts, New York City and other cities around the country, states like Massachusetts are setting aggressive carbon emissions limits and carbon emissions reduction goals for 2030, 2040, and 2050. And a lot of that is focused on developing renewables. The problem is, as you pointed out, Austin, renewables have, until we build up storage
a limited ability to meet the needs all the time of the grid and of our customers. So how do you help our customers in an aggressive regulatory environment get what they're get what they need, which is reliable power that stays on even in outages, which will increase in a climate chaotic world, but reduces carbon emissions.
Yeah. It's just that a reduction, a 30% reduction in your energy demand is equivalent to an instantaneously dispatchable and free energy resource that would meet 30% of your demand. Right, and so think of it in those terms, and then you realize just how sexy efficiency is.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, LED lights, right? The low hanging fruit of the industry. The fact that they aren't, you know, fully adopted yet is crazy. You know, last year I think Grid, you were at a meeting where Grid said, you know, they were only at 15 or 20% adoption rate, and we're talking about a power source that can, you know, you have your old incandescent lamp that might be 100 watts. You can bring that all the way down to 20. That's 80 watts times a building that might have a couple thousand of those. That payback, depending on how long those lamps are on during a day, is literally sometimes less than a year. And when you look at solar, that return on investment, if you don't have any of the tax incentives just from producing that power, could be 10 or 15 years. And when people see that, they just from, you know, if you present both side by side, they would obviously choose LED lights because that's the better option. And it's going to improve the look and the feel of the building. But from a PR side, you can't do a press release about 1,000 LED lights. I mean, you can, but it's certainly not going to make everyone feel that you're investing as much into the environment as, even though LEDs do just as much, if not more.
So I just had a thought of when you're comparing residential or residential solar versus residential energy efficiency, it's a no-brainer. But I think that when you're expanding renewables to a utility scale, where you have offshore wind mills running that provide terawatt hours of energy to a state, I think that energy efficiency works well, and it's a very good investment on that on a utility scale into renewables, even if they are not providing energy all the time. Even if I'm assuming there's no storage, okay, in this situation, but I think it makes it, it's a very good value add to the whole system and in decarbonizing a state's energy consumption. But yeah, just to go back to your point, on a residential scale, it's a no-brainer to definitely have energy efficiency, but and not go in for solar directly, but first clean up your energy consumption.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, Ani. It's always a both and. It's going to take all of these solutions to get to the goals we've set, and certainly large scale renewable projects like offshore wind can take a big chunk out of the goals that have been set for the next 30 years. And as Mike said, and I've never actually thought of it that way, as you pointed out, Mike, we were at a meeting with one of the two largest utilities here in Massachusetts, and a year ago the penetration into the market of LED lights was 15%, between 15 and 20. My guess is it's still shy of 30%. Now a year later, at least in the public consciousness, the penetration of solar into the marketplace for available solar projects feels like it's a lot more than that. So it's just interesting that the lowest cost first move is harder to sell than the sort of popular, well-known, and again, we got nothing against solar, but it's an interesting challenge for our industry and challenge for Renew, but challenge for all of us that care about hitting these climate goals, that the first best thing to do is efficiency, but it's not nearly as attractive to customers at the commercial or residential scale than what should be the second move, which is the on-site renewables.
Yeah. I mean, I've sold solar. People get giddy about it. They get really excited.
You know,
there's a business owner. He was, you know, he had a Tesla, and he was like, oh, I'm going to get a stick that says powered by the sun. And you know, he was very excited, did a bunch of press releases around it. But at the same time, the LEDs are, and actually to your point about what the adoption rate is in terms of solar in Massachusetts, because they have a net metering cap, we know that solar only produces about 7%, can't produce more than 7% of the total utility energy usage here in Mass.
Because that's a cap on net metering?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
other states have lower caps. I've seen 2%.
Yeah, which is a whole other issue. I mean...
But what do you have any idea what the percentage of essentially viable solar, setting aside the net metering cap, what's the...
Everyone, I mean, like, there's definitely been reports that people say 25% of the rooftops are a good viable source for solar.
Okay.
And which is probably true. I mean, and so, right, in the future, it's going to be a combination of absolutely utility wind, which... If you look at the levelized cost of energy over 20 years, the cheapest form of energy you can get, cheaper than coal, cheaper than gas, cheaper than nuclear, it's an offshore wind, great utility rate. So a combination of utility storage, utility solar, utility wind, but before you produce, you must reduce. And as someone once told me, if it rhymes, it's true.
And the utility wind, it's, you know, Governor Baker just met with the federal regulators to try to hammer these things through, right? That Cape Wind back in the day was killed in grand fashion, and that Vineyard Wind is running into these regulatory problems, and we need to hammer right through that, because indeed New England is perfect for offshore wind. So right, the wind density off the coast of New England is world class,
right?
Whereas the UV density in New England is not world class. And so we've got to figure out exactly what's holding up Vineyard Wind and get the New Bedford port infrastructure in place so you can move these colossal pieces. It's quite a thing. So
yeah,
and then that just dovetails with efficiency. But to do that and not invest in efficiency is cutting off your nose to spite your face, shooting yourself in the foot, doing the one step forward, two steps back. I don't know what the
all
expression
of the
is.
Above.
All the bad things. That, you know, again, they don't
tying
lie,
one hand behind your back.
It is,
sure.
Exactly. Blindfolded? I don't know.
So what's interesting, and we're actually just about to start a marketing program here at Renew for our business, but it's very interesting to figure out, I'm sure people have done this, how do you try to make efficiency more attractive so that people put a sticker on their car about it?
Yeah.
Maybe the answer is never, but maybe we just haven't tried enough.
Well,
you know?
I mean, if you think about it, if you bring it down to like the very smallest level and say, we're going to take something away from you, right? If we're going to give you the ability to use less, you know, what does that do for somebody? Not for me, it doesn't do a lot. I mean, if you break it down to that level,
right?
Where if I say, oh, I'm going to put something shiny on your roof and it's going to produce power, right?
Yeah, the technology is cool, and there's something that I think people get a kick out of being able to say that they made their own power. The fact, the idea that you're replacing the power plant with your own equipment and that it's, you know, powered by the sun. I get the attraction. I'm just wondering if somewhere in this efficiency game there's a similar... Maybe we need to play up the technology more. You know, some of the technology that we're finding in our projects is remarkably interesting. Certainly at the corporate level or at the commercial level, we've got, you know, we've got a company that whose founder was putting a cold pack in his... daughter's lunchbox and realized that this would be an incredible technology for reducing energy use in cold storage warehouses. And guess what? It works.
I'm wondering if we could leverage a sports analogy for the distinction between efficiency and renewable generation. So we know that, for our baseball-obsessed listeners, that of course big bats are sexy. You love to bring in the Aaron Judge, the Barry Bonds,
right,
the Mookie Betts. What wins in October? Pitching.
Right.
Pitching, pitching. Don't let the other team score runs so that you can win a game 3-1. If you have to win every game 11-10, you're not going to win.
It's like
the same idea. It's the exact same idea. Right. Pitching wins in October. It's less exciting in the regular season.
Or in football, you know, offense gets all the glory.
Absolutely. It always. You know, like hockey, yeah. Again, it's like, you know, so what would you rather have? A goalie who can stop?
So we're like the defensive line. Of climate change.
Well, so the D line is so critical and is the least exciting part of the team by far.
We're like the right fielder.
Right.
And to all the cricket listeners, you don't go for the batsman's always. You have to look at the bowler and the field bins who catch. So wickets are more important than just hitting sixes
absolutely.
All the time.
Absolutely.
There you go. For those cricket fans.
Yeah.
So, but really though, that we're talking about how do we market this and say that if the educated consumer knows that, you know, pitching is what wins in October, then maybe efficiency is what will save the species now. We've got to make that connection.
I like it. Maybe we should begin a whole campaign around we're the defensive line of climate change.
We have already underplayed ourselves at the defensive
line. In the last line of defense. Because this is good. That's a tagline.
The first line of defense.
Sorry. Right. The defensive line and the first line of defense
right.
against species.
I think we're on to something.
Let's go, you know.
And more taglines. We need to come up with a tagline for our maple bacon. So Clamaganza was good this and then... wrap it all together and we'll finally make efficiency sexy.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Alright, we'll actually find a defensive liner to be a part of our marketing campaign.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Our celebrity spokesperson will be a
Big Vince Wilfork.
Will be Vince Wilfork.
So
that's a defensive lineman from the Patriots for many years.
Yeah,
I see.
Who was?
I did not get that reference. I'm a transplant.
He was the anchor of our defensive line. He was he was huge.
Yeah,
back in the day.
No, he's still huge. Yeah,
he's huge. He just retired a couple of years ago.
Yeah. All right. Well, on that note, you know, maple syrup and defense. You can't go wrong.
You can't go wrong.
The best place to start: maple for breakfast. Defense, energy efficiency, you know, we'll work on that. But that's where we are for this episode. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, folks.
Bye now.